Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to a newly revived edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm Imam Alfred Muhammad. I'm along with my co-host, Alfred Y. Muhammad, 2020 Morehouse College. And today we're speaking with the Honorable Garrett Felber, Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Mississippi. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Professor, I'm honored to have you on the show. I'd like, by the way of background, want to know how did you come to this study, but by way of getting a better understanding of you, tell us a little bit about yourself biographically so we can get a historiographical understanding of Professor Felber. And I should add to our audience that Professor Felber is the author of Those Who Know Don't Say, The Nation of Islam, The Black Freedom Movement, and The Carceral State, the Honorable Garrett Felber, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Mississippi.
Yeah, so I really came to this project. I was working on a master's in African American Studies at Columbia University under the late Manning Marable, and he had been, as you know, working on a decades-long biography of Malcolm X, which became A Life of Reinvention. And while I was working on that project as a research assistant, I was in the archives and I was seeing things that I thought complicated his reading of the Nation of Islam's political engagement and Malcolm's sort of singular role in that vision that he portrayed. So this project kind of grew out of my questions from what I was seeing in the archive and my own reading of especially how the nation's politics were played out in response to the carceral state.
And what led you to study African American history? I assume that you, from looking at your picture, that you're a non-African American. And just what would lead a nice, well, you didn't tell us where you're from. I don't want to tell the audience where you're from. Like, brother, you didn't tell the audience where you're from. Just how you got interested in African American studies. You know, I've often asked people how they got interested in European studies, how they got interested in the Far Eastern studies, Islamic studies, and that's not their culture. Tell us how that interest developed.
Yeah, so your question, how did a Midwestern white boy wind up in African-American studies?
I prefer calling for me, you it was Caucasian, because a white boy is kind of, it can be derisive. I certainly don't see you as a boy and not as a white boy, because I don't like using racial constructions. So I will say, as a Caucasian-American, European-American, how did you come there? But I'll take all of that, what you said, with passion.
I appreciate that. So, yeah, no, I came to African-American studies in part through jazz. So I grew up listening to jazz, playing saxophone, and in particular, Amiri Baraka's book Blues People had an impact on me. I read it during college. And just started thinking about racial appropriation of jazz, how jazz, a black art form, became considered in some circles this kind of lingua franca. And I thought a lot about, I came to Columbia actually expecting to write about jazz, and then I just got kind of sucked into the vortex of Malcolm X, or what we came to call Malcolmology. So that really took me in a different direction, I guess.
So it was the culture of the people, and even studying jazz kind of would lead one to have an interest in Islam, because Islam certainly influenced mm-hmm. a lot of the jazz. This is the great Makar Tyner that recently passed. But my co-host, Alfred Y. Muhammad, grandfather, was a pretty well-known jazz musician by the name of Rahman Herbie Morgan, that played with Amiri Baraka in the Spirit House movement. So we might very well
oh, wow.
be discussing that. So he's with me now, and maybe Al-Fawai Muhammad may pose some questions to you.
No, yeah, I just want to say before, you know, you continue on with your about your journey, you know, in terms of, you know, writing about the Nation of Islam and everything that came with it. Growing up, actually, when my family would have cookouts and everything like that, Amir Baraka would be there. And apparently my dad says all the time that, you know, I used to always ask Amir Baraka when I was, like, little. I used to say, you know, why don't you write a book about Spider-Man? You know, because, like, at the time, like, I was a real big fan of Spider-Man. And he would be like, no, I'm not going to write a, you know, because everybody told me he was a writer. And so they were like, well, I'm not going to write about, you know, Spider-Man. That's your job. And he would call, affectionately call my brother and I, you know, Big Head and Little Head, because my brother had a bigger head than I did. So he would just call me Little Head, and my brother Joseph was Big Head. So it's interesting you brought up Amir Baraka, because he was a good friend of my granddad, and he would always be around him. So, yeah.
Yes, Professor, let's go back and look at some of the history, having teased out your background, and now understanding the person that is seeing this material. What jumped out at you as a scholar, a Malcolmologist, now I see you as a neo-Malcolmologist. The Malcolm Church would probably turn over that grave or in their pews if they lie isolated to her that you would extrapolate and even argue with the great Peniel Joseph, who seemed to think that Malcolm was a singular figure, Christ riding off the cross to save the poor black community, and after he'd gone, the African American community and the carceral state rolled on. But it's kind of quite different than what we have been presented, a representation. Would you comment on that?
Yeah. So, one of the things that I always was frustrated with was the way that people tend to read history backwards in a way that kind of takes Malcolm's leaving the nation as inevitable. And I think this comes from the autobiography and the way that the autobiography is written. And I'm happy to talk about that and Alex Haley's role in that and that whole sort of text and how it influences the way that people think about Malcolm and the nation. But I think because the way people have relied on the autobiography, they read Malcolm as inevitably leaving the nation, and that the reason he left the nation was because he wanted to pull it in a political direction, and that Elijah Muhammad, and by sort of extension, the entire organization, was reluctant or recalcitrant in doing that. And I think if we are good students of history, we read people in their moment. So we don't read it backwards, but we think about, well, how did people who joined, say, the nation in 1962, how did they see themselves and how did they see Malcolm? And, you know, Malcolm is the national spokesperson for the organization, but to be the national spokesperson, presumably he's speaking on behalf of other people's views. So I always thought it was kind of a bizarre way to think about it, that why would you have a national spokesperson who's saying something that's at odds with the entire organization? So we have to understand that people who were in the organization were drawn to these ideas. And I think the other thing that we make a mistake of doing is just getting so caught up into the internal strife between leadership, especially at the national level, that when we look at what's happening at the local level or grassroots, especially in prisons or in places like LA, we lose a lot of the sort of complications of history, which are that, as I point out in the book, you know, there are relationships between, say, a local NAACP chapter and Muslims in the nation, which if you look at the national level, you would think could never happen. So I think there's just a couple ways that we, you know, it's not to say Malcolm's not an exceptional figure. He is. I mean, I think we can agree on that. But to read someone who's speaking on behalf of an organization as speaking at the same time against it or at odds with its membership, to me, never made sense.
Well, you know, you have a fresh approach, and I think that it is sad to say, but it's real to say, a non-African American would develop an objective thinking about the material as opposed to those who had invested mythologizing about the material, which leads me to another question. Mike Sims, who is the brother of John Ali, who's formerly John Sims, his wife is currently an academic at the University of Florida. And when you brought that to my attention, it brought back a flood of memory of the nation's growth, greater growth. So if it were single-handedly Malcolm, the nation would have collapsed. But obviously that's not the case. And I think now you all begin to see history from below. So that brother standing on the corner of 125th Street, standing at the gate to Columbia University, was as much responsible for the growth of the Nation of Islam than as ministers moving on the national front. They were known, but the local rank and file member was actually responsible for growth. Which now brings us to the question I want to go now to something that you have put a great emphasis on, is the normalization of the Nation of Islam, and discuss the very complex relationship and historiographical work of the C. Eric Lincoln. Kind of fit in the text you teased out. Lincoln's kind of duplicative war. I don't know what we could call it, duplicity. But I probably in a barbershop discussion, I would call it duplicitous. But from the scholarly dimension, how would you assess Lincoln as an arbiter of facts and an interpreter of the lost found Nation of Islam?
Yeah, I would love to get your opinion on this too, because I vacillated in this project about whether I was going too hard or too easy on C. Eric Lincoln, and I never really could figure out whether I was on one side or the other. So Lincoln,
if you
the
answer,
reason I give so
I
much. Okay, that's a deal.
I'll be glad to answer. If you want, I'd rather for you to go first. You are the guest, and the guest always can escape. I can't, but I prefer. One thing I hate to go on people's radio shows or her radio interviews, and people take up the interview does more talking than the person who is being interviewed. So I'd like to have your opinion personally.
Okay. Well, as long as it's a deal that we can chat about C. Eric Lincoln. So his book is, I think it's up until this point, understudied or underemphasized in the literature, just how important his book was to shaping the way that outsiders viewed the Nation of Islam. So, you know, I write about how he comes to the project. He's thinking about doing a dissertation, maybe a chapter, but really can't get his dissertation committee to sign off to a full project. And what he does is he uses the Hate That Hate produced miniseries that Lou Lomax and Mike Wallace do. That popularity he uses as kind of a lever to pitch this full-length project. And one of the things that I emphasize in the book is that the Nation of Islam to this point is not ever using the term black Muslims, that phrase is something that he coins, and that it doesn't make any sense really to folks in the nation to use black Muslims, because, you know, it's black people are Muslims, right? So that's to sort of say black Muslims is to one, be redundant, and two, to distance people in the movement from so-called Orthodox Islam. So he does that, and I don't think that part is necessarily – I think that's mostly his clumsiness. And it's interesting because in the dissertation, he's a lot more careful than in the book. So he does a lot of parsing in the dissertation that fades away by the book. But the thing that winds up kind of happening, and this is why I waffle on how much to attribute to him versus other people. So one thing that is duplicitous is that he has a very different way of talking to the Nation of Islam about his project than to white liberals. Black academic at that time, I think there's reasons why he's doing that kind of code switching. But he's sort of pitching himself to Elijah Muhammad as a sympathetic interpreter in the face of the hate that hate produced and the bad, you know, sort of press that they're, the nation's getting. Now, the part that I'm not sympathetic with is that his book and his framework gets taken up a lot by law enforcement. So it's being read by William Parker, chief of police in Los Angeles. It's being read by the inspector of prisons in New York, and they're sharing information from the book with one another. But not just that, he's sharing information with them. So he sort of situates himself. And the other thing that I'm sure you'll remember is that there's a lot of literature that's coming out right around this time about the Nation of Islam. There's S.U. Newdom's book. There's Lewis Lomax.
Right.
There's Lincoln. There's why am I blanking on his name? Haywood from Harvard. So Lincoln's kind of trying to jockey for position as the academic spokesperson on the nation. And what he does is he really shares a lot of information with, you know, Georgia Bureau of Investigation, with LAPD, and goes and starts talking on kind of a circuit to law enforcement. So that's the part I'm not sympathetic about. And I think that really has a dramatic effect on ramping up the way that the NOI gets policed in the early 60s.
I happen to agree with you. One thing I would say about Dr. Lincoln is that he was a very hostile person to anybody inside the nation, in subsequent to the community that was engaging in scholarship. He was cold. He was not helpful. I met him several times at Duke. Woody Mamworthy Muhammad. And I think that's the only time he would have given me the time of day, because I was with Imam Waqi Muhammad. And he used that same deception. Oh, Imam Muhammad, I could have easily been converted by you last night from that lecture. And Imam, you told my father the same thing. And he kind of looked at me and laughed. And he had made it his business. I frankly, subconsciously, I think he was very hostile. I believe you pointed out in your work, he was a Methodist preacher. And I think he never gave up the craft of protecting Christianity. I think he did a very subtle slide of the hand with sociology of religion and mixed it in with Gordon Allport, who said these are basically social deviants, and presented it that way, which would lead law enforcement to see these people as psychopaths and probably jeopardize a lot of people's lives rather than explaining it. I think it was a very sinister plot by Lincoln. I was not a fan of Lincoln at all, and lectures where he was around, I was not very warm to him and to people who dealt with him. I thought he was very deceptive. You are the only one I have read, with the exception of Curtis, that really understood the material. You just understood, and I think what it is, you didn't come with any baggage. I mean, this is the last thing to say. I met Alex Haley, and I talked with him. Alex Haley presented one thing to the public, and that's another problem that in covering the material in itself is somewhat duplicitous. So you have to be careful. What are you reading? You say, well, what Malcolm are you talking about? When did he say this? And so unless you understand content and signifying, as Skip Gates would call it, you really don't get the picture. You just dug into the material and came up with these conclusions with the facts leading it. The material is right there before the eyes. You wrote it more from an interior, but yet objective, not, you know, behind kissing, I don't know what y'all in the contemporary would call it. I do know I can't say it on the air. But, I mean, I have a 22-year-old son, so if he were describing the material in your class in a private session, he would describe it a little different than that, and I would describe it. But nonetheless, I want to, because I think this is a very important how Parker and the people in corrections saw the Nation of Islam, and how they were heavily influenced by Lincoln, and what the let me add to it, and Lomax. Lomax was another duplicitous person, more so than Wallace, because Lomax was the one that really put the FBI label on John Simmons, John Ali. And there was no basis for that. No one in the nation. I mean, I basically knew by name the three spies that started in 31, and later on I knew it. And when we went through the records, we found out who those people were because they had died. So, I mean, he put names on people. So these kind of duplicitous people, you have to be a detective, and you coming behind them, you have done the one job. I wonder when you comment. I'll give you a lot of material, and maybe you can do it in 10 minutes or less. And you'll get bonus for your silence. Yes, go ahead.
No, I think you're right. There was a moment of intense public scrutiny of the Nation of Islam, particularly post Hate That Hate produced between 59 and escalating through the 60s and through the mid 60s. And into that void, there was a lot of opportunism. And Alex Haley fit that bill. Lou Lomax did. C. Eric Lincoln did. They were playing multiple audiences, and they relied on access to the nation to some degree, to Malcolm or to others. But they also relied on access to the FBI. I mean, you have someone like Haley who's writing, an article, for example, in 63 for the Saturday Evening Post with a white journalist, Alfred Bock, and they're using FBI materials to write the article. It's that hack job. They write Black Merchants of Hate. And then at the same time, he's pitching the autobiography to Malcolm. So there's just a lot of, opportunism and. No, go ahead.
I said, going regularly to the Henri Elijah Muhammad's house in Phoenix. In fact, Abdullah Muhammad made it possible to do the first article, I believe, in Reader's Digest. He couldn't get published, and he got this person. He said, look, I can get you directly to Elijah Muhammad. And he went in ingratiating himself and why Mr. Muhammad was coughing. He's patting his back. And, he just became like a household figure around in Phoenix. So, I mean, these guys were birds, but they really operate like, and I think about it, you talk about the corporal state, they operate like good cop, bad cop.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they didn't have, I mean, it wasn't just personal opportunism. They didn't have the political analysis to do the right work. So, someone like Lincoln, he didn't think there was anything wrong, I don't think, with going to, a police convention and talking about the nation, because as you said, one, he had a pretty negative view of the nation, and two, he didn't have a critical view of the police. So a lot of these folks, I don't think are necessarily, I mean, they are duplicitous in the sense that they're talking out of two sides of their mouth, but they're also, they don't have the political analysis to understand the nation's work. I mean, that's the problem with the Haley Malcolm sort of, co-authorship of the autobiography is Alex Haley is not at all equipped to understand the political analysis, the structural analysis that Malcolm's giving him. He
and
wants to tell the story of an individual sort of, go ahead.
Three of those persons I've come to know, they didn't even have a concern. They remind me of many opportunities that African American, I'm using this appropriating Marxist Leninist term. And I shouldn't be. I'm not a Marxist, Lenin, but I do know the analysis. They were opportunists. They didn't have any really position at all other than careerism. That was the black. They didn't seek a political analysis. They pretended to everybody. Well, to the establishment, they said, I'm your boy. To us, they were saying, I'm your guy to protect you from the big bad wolf. But actually, I'm going to feed you to the big bad wolf. And I'm referencing the big bad wolf because, in some of the earlier material in Chicago, the sisters challenged the police. I said, who is afraid? No, in Alabama. Who is afraid of the big bad wolf? So before we tease that part of the story out, I want to make, if you care to comment on ideology and what type of analysis would have been required of them to sufficiently understand this material.
I mean, they would have to understand black nationalism, which they don't, clearly. But they would also have to have a structural analysis of racial capitalism, too, which they don't. I mean, they were, at best, liberals who sort of saw, I think in some ways, their own success as evidence of what the movement was about, right? That it was about this kind of liberal notion of inclusion. And I'm not even sure Haley was that far. But they didn't have a structural critique of racial capitalism, that's for sure. And they didn't have an understanding of black nationalism in a serious way. I think they saw it as you say, as deviant. Or, I mean, to me, the pivotal thing is that Lincoln's using the same language as the hate that hate produced. They're all using the language
right.
that black nationalism is nothing but the bitter fruit of white racism. And if that is your framework, then you're going to have your work used by cops against the nation. I mean, that's the framework that they're using to delegitimize the NOI as what they're calling a hate group or black supremacy or whatever, and say that this is not, they're using religion as a cover for these more sinister racist beliefs, right? That's the state's analysis. And it pretty much falls in line with the analysis that Haley and Lincoln and others, I think, take up wholesale from the hate that hate produced.
I think you're being charitable. One of your co-historians, Alfred Weimar, would like to ask you a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to just add in something about what you were talking about in terms of Alex Haley and Louis Lomax and all the other figures that you mentioned and how they lack the political analysis or, you know, in order to sort of analyze the material. And they also lack, you said they had, both you and my father said that they had a sense of, like, opportunism when they were going about talking about this, the Nation of Islam. And I want to say, these two, I guess, aspects that you mentioned of their analysis, both the poor political analysis side and I think the opportunism has played a part in the creation, like I guess the creation or the narrative of the Nation of Islam. And I think the ramifications that it has had can be seen, you know, throughout, I think through the younger generations. Like, I mean, I'm going to say this and then I guess like you could have some feedback on it. Like, you know, I'm 22 years old. I wrote a paper about a 36-page paper about the Nation of Islam when I was, and Imam Wardi Muhammad when I was at Stanford. And, you know, I talked to kids, I was on an exchange program when I was at Morehouse, but I talked to kids about, you know, like my age about, you know, Malcolm X, and I talked to them about the Nation of Islam. And I'm hearing what they're saying to me. I'm getting feedback about what they're saying to me about the Nation of Islam, you know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. And what they are telling me, I mean, it's just completely skewed, you know. And, I mean, of course, you know, my dad, I don't want me to say his age on the air and everything like that, but I have an older dad. You know, he's been around the Nation of Islam for a long time. And a lot of my dad's friends, you know, are my mentors and everything. And what they are saying is the complete opposite. And I think that's just because of, you know, the skew and I guess the bend of the Nation of Islam's history. And I think you even seen that, like, to this day. I mean, like, there was a recent documentary that came out. There's a recent documentary that came out about the Nation of Islam. And I watched a little bit of it. And even that has an ideological bend to it. And no history is, you know, like, I guess, you know, is neutral, right? Everything has a bend to it. But, I mean, the Nation of Islam, the story itself, I think it's just overall not been taught and hasn't been wrote about you know, very well, and even it hasn't even tried to be neutral. I think as a result, a lot of the kids my age, and I think future generations, have seen it just in a totally weird light, as opposed to what a guy like me has seen, or what, you know, my brother, my sister, you know, kids who came out of Nation of Islam have seen. Can you talk a little bit about that? I guess the ramifications of the political analysis and the opportunism.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm constantly frustrated with what to teach when I teach about the nation, is because, you know, the autobiography is such a good text to kind of get people in the door, in a sense, because it's an engaging narrative, but you have to do so much deconstruction. And at the textual level of, okay, well, what is memoir? And then so much of it is getting people to think about, and this is a point that Imam Alfred made earlier about, when did a person say something and why is that important? So I constantly try to get my students to think about, when did Malcolm decide he was going to write the autobiography? With whom did he decide to write it? What are Alex Haley's motivations for pitching this book? And what are Malcolm's for agreeing to do it? And once you kind of realize where Malcolm is in his life when he decides to write this book, and then you understand what happens in his life during the process of writing it, and then you layer on what Alex Haley's doing. And by the end of the book, Alex Haley's already interested in writing Roots. So he's trying to get done with this project, and Malcolm's like going through this full transformation, and Alex Haley doesn't want anything to do with sitting through to see Malcolm's, you know, full transformation. He wanted to write basically the first 6 chapters of that book. He wanted to write about Malcolm growing up hustling, then, you know, going to prison, converting to Islam, and that was Malcolm's idea of what the book would look like, because he wanted it to be a testament to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So all of this is a lot of unpacking that's required to even get to the point where we can read the autobiography and understand anything, right, from that book. And I think the other thing I'm always struck by with the Nation of Islam in popular imagination, and this isn't just the younger generations, this goes to boomer generation lefties as well. People think they know the nation. It's not a group that people say, well, I just have no idea. People really do believe they understand the NOI and they understand Malcolm.
Yep.
So you're constantly coming up against people who are like, oh, no, I can't tell you the number of times that I've written something and gotten an anonymous peer review, and they're like, no, you just don't understand the Nation of Islam. And I'm like, I don't even know if this person – I mean, it's not to say I have some sort of grasp upon the nation, but, you know, this is from someone who doesn't even study this. And they're just like, no, you're getting it all wrong. You need to understand this, this, and this. And the things they're telling me to understand are the basic popular narratives. So you have people who are regurgitating kind of popular discourse to someone who spent a decade thinking about it. And that's just to say that people feel very firm in their convictions about what they know. So part of what's so frustrating is getting people to think about, well, where do you get that from? How do you know this about the Nation of Islam? How do you know this about Malcolm? And when it boils down to it, it's usually just one book or one sort of anecdote. And I guess part of what I was trying to do with this book is show how deep these ideas go, that the idea of not just the Nation of Islam as being kind of quasi-reverse racism, but even the idea of black nationalism as that really takes hold in the hate that hate produced, that creates a whole framework for white liberals to say racism is bad, but we're not the only ones. Black people are racist too. And how appealing that is for white liberals at the time to say that. So there's this whole way, and to this day, the use of black Muslims in a kind of ahistorical way. So people don't know that this term was conjured up by a single person, and that, you know, for years Malcolm was saying, we're not black Muslims. And at some point he just starts saying, you know, this is the term that people recognize. So he starts using it. But I think so much of it is just a complete lack of understanding about the specific moments in history where these things turn and get taken up by a lot of uninformed and sort of willfully misinformed people. But I guess the political analysis part of your question goes back to people really don't want to know either. They want
that is the problem. It's a mind please. With the exception of again, Brent Turner, I think about Edward Curtis, yourself, it's a minority. They won't even look at the material. They'll come to me. Someone recently did a project. I'm not at liberty to speak of the project because I was under contract. But I mean, I done the project with the person. The person agreed with me, and they wrote or whatever they did was all the opposite, and they knew the material. That's why I'm talking about deliberate distortion. The one thing I will say you have to understand, first of all, black nationalism. If you don't understand black nationalism, if you don't understand what I would call non-mainstream African-American religion, and really in-depth understand the recurring themes in African-American history, you don't come to the Nation of Islam. I mean, you can't really even understand the Nation of Islam unless you understand people like Elijah Lovejoy. So you have to have a religious understanding of African-American, that much of the so-called African Methodism was a protest movement. So, I mean, these people, the sad thing, even working with professors, they don't want to know.
And that's what I was going to comment on, is that, you know, I've dialogued, and my father has too, with like major academic, figures, you know what I mean? They've, been major universities, major institutions, and you talk to them about, and they know about my background. You know, my father was in the Nation of Islam. And I talk to them about the history of the Nation of Islam, and they know that I know a little bit about the Nation of Islam.
You know a lot.
Yeah, I know a great deal. And it seems like they just try to purposely avoid, talking about this subject. And I'm just like, how are you? I mean, you look at me dead in my eye, and you're literally avoiding an ongoing moment in history. That has had a major effect on a large group in this country, African Americans. You know, I always tell people, I said, the reason why kids are walking around with the name like, Raheem and everything and stuff like that, and all these semi-Muslim names, that's because of us. That's because of the Nation of Islam, or what the organization my father at one point was affiliated with. So I'm saying, there's this, in the academic world, there seems to be this. I don't know. I don't want this cabal where they don't really want to talk about the subject, and they just kind of move away from it. And it's really sad, because how are you going to talk about, black nationalism and, kind of just be like, well, the Nation of Islam, and, it was a thing, moving on. You mm-hmm. know, that's what it kind of seems like, is going on. But I digress.
No, that's quite all right. I want to, because I think we're going to have to do this in a two-part. I don't want to hold you away, but I know you have babysitting and issues and things that you have to deal with. But I do want to, one of the reasons I was invited to participate in two projects on Malcolm, your mentor and I, God bless his soul, I didn't want to deal with him. I don't expect you to comment on it. I don't want you to risk any good name you may have in the academy. And the academy, as you know, is very small. Mm-hmm. And we don't want you to get whitelisted or white ball. So cause it can happen with this whole Malcolm project. I mean, it's just a bad thing. Anyway, before I move on to something that is very important in this material, I just find guys don't really want to have any real discussion. And they don't have a background. I mean, in other words, I get Pierre Glinken, because I had conversation, and I get of all of these people, I really get Alex Haley. Alex Haley, I tell you, I spent a whole day with him, and he was a con man. And I get a con man. I've met many con men all my life. I had a brother who was a con man, so I met Alex Haley, I just have to tell this story because it's interesting. I met Alex Haley walking down the street in Madison, Wisconsin one day. And he asked me, do you know where to meet, where I can find Jan Vancini? See, yeah, I said, sure, I could get to meet him. And I took him up to the meeting. And after, and I don't know if he was ingratiating himself with me or not, but I took him to the student union, the Rathskeller in Madison, the student union. And I said, Alex, tell the people about the Malcolm versus Deion Black Muhammad. And he gave a Nation of Islam defense of Deion Black Muhammad. I don't know if he was doing it for me or because he needed me to take it to Jan Vancina because he was on to this fictional material to write the book, The Roots. And Vancina was an expert on oral history, and he needed to create this false narrative by Dufour Wright. I think in a lot of ways, Alex Haley admired Islam, if he admired anything else. I think it's admirable of Mr. Muhammad. But Alex Haley would sell you the Brooklyn Bridge if he thought it would get him some money. And there was a piece done on Alex Haley in the Village Voice. But when one of his sons came to him, asked him for money, Alex Haley told his son, "But son, you know that I'm dying." So, I mean, this is the kind of guy you're dealing with. Whereas Lincoln was very sanctimonious, academic, mixing pretense. To me, like I said, I could easily figure Haley's right. I really don't even think Alex Haley liked Malcolm. I know that Lincoln didn't particularly care for us at all. I got that feeling. He liked the top officials, and at the time I was a top official in A team, Anwar C. Muhammad, so he ingratiated himself to me. But he didn't like me with a burden. But I was going to say, in reference to the man in Marable to me about the Malcolm thing, asked me. Actually, he was wanting to buy Baraka's papers, and I was trying to sell the papers of Baraka to Columbia. And he said to me, well, you know, I'm working on the Malcolm. So I said, the first person you should talk to who is living is Benjamin Kareem. And he didn't even want to waste the time. Next thing, Benjamin died. Now, it would seem to me, if you want to know Malcolm, you would want to go to a person who hadn't gone to jail, who was Malcolm's assistant, the person that introduced Malcolm. Well, you know who Benjamin Kareem is. The man that introduced Malcolm, they died. So I'm saying, if you're going to be that, if you are going to deviate from such stance, that's the first guy I would want to talk to him. Before I go to talk to James, I want to talk to him. That's Malcolm's top minister after he leaves the nation. But Malcolm's top assistant while he was in the nation. So, I mean, when you don't go that route, then I think you've got a story to sell. I don't think you're really looking for interesting information. I sell, it's like Taylor Branch. I sell, everybody I told him to interview. I mean, I'm not a professional historian, but I certainly know how to get you through this patch, this prior patch of the nation. It's very difficult to negotiate. I mean, one has to be almost a detective to make sense of this material. I mean, it's very cryptic. But I want to now go back to the heart of your subject, of your book, which is the state, and start with the incident in Alabama of the Muslim sisters on their way to the Savior's Day Convention. And if you would tell us about that incident, and that's what kind of policy ensued as a result of that. Again, one of the myths being broken, Muslim women all being in the kitchen cooking bean soup and bean pie. Actually, I'm getting hungry as I think about the bean pie. But will you tease that story out for us?
Yeah, so this was a story, actually, I spent the better part of a year trying to get more information about, and everything that I was able to get on it, and Eula Taylor writes about it in her wonderful book as well. And I really just could never quite expand it beyond what I write about in the introduction. But basically, it's in Flemington, Alabama, a small little railroad junction town. And there's two, as you said, two Muslim sisters on the way to Savior's Day. I believe this is in 1957. And essentially this, you know, white police officer in Alabama, even got the name Red Hemby. So he comes over and says, you know, you're sitting in an all-white section, and they sort of protest, and then these men with the Fruit of Islam come over and say, you know, you're talking to us. And the reason I tell that story is for a couple of reasons. One, because I think it disrupts a lot of things. I mean, for one, even for me coming to this project, thinking about the NOI in Alabama in 1957 took me a second, because we often get it as a northern movement.
yeah.
Rarely, especially in the 50s, rarely in the South, right, in the rural South. And they were coming from an Air Force base, right? So they were in, I think, Eglin or Elgin, Florida.
Elgin, Florida.
Yeah. So I like that story because it disrupts a lot of things that we think about of the nation being strictly an urban northern phenomenon. I like, as you said, that it disrupts the idea that that Muslim women were not political, because clearly they were doing things that we see in the civil rights struggle all the time as written in a political way. But it does also get to, you know, the sort of politics of protection as well, that the men see the women doing this and sort of intervene and say, no, in fact, you're talking to us. So I think even though I was never able to get a lot. Oh, and I guess the one other thing I should say about this story that's unique is the men wind up having a scuffle with the police officer, disarm him and beat him up. And they wind up, Malcolm comes down and they get out on, I think it's $200 bail or a $200 fine. So that was the reason I was really interested in this story, was because certainly in 1957 in Alabama, two black men beating up a police chief, you know, that speaks to the power of the nation, that they were, that Malcolm was able to come down and get them off with a $200 fine. So that was the thing that I was really interested in. And there's a guy down there, John LaFleur with the NAACP, who also was trying to get involved in the case. And I just really couldn't follow all the threads to what happens to kind of lead to that resolution. But I just thought it was a story that unpacks a lot of different things that complicate our kind of ready-made narratives about the NOI.
I hope to invite you to one of our conventions. We have it. We have a historic place where you can interview some of those people. Some of those people will be there. I know that family. Also, you might recall the incident in 1933 in Chicago, in the courthouse, where there was a scuffle again broke out. Again, I don't know where the nation got this language from. I've been in the nation since 1960. Who is afraid of the big bad wolf? But they kind of called the Caucasian a wolf. And there's a fight broke out, and they arrest, and Taylor covers this more. But I want you to do that because I want you to kind of analyze, what effect did this have on correctional officers? What effect this had on other black prisoners in the sense of what Frantz Fanon talks about in breaking the authority pattern? I mean, this was must have been very traumatizing to the police of Chicago and Alabama. In fact, I was told in Alabama they never – they were told not to come back to Alabama. These were felony charges of assault and police, but they wanted to keep it so quiet that the police chief got his behind whipped by three misfitted Muslims in there. And that story is never told. I don't hear any of the historians discussing that. At least Udom covers it, and Taylor covers it, and to some extent, how do you think Lincoln covers that?
Yeah, I mean, the in the most basic sense, it makes law enforcement petrified. One of the things that I really found helpful in this project is I spent as much time or more maybe covering the law enforcement view, right? So this book is about the nation, but it's also about police and prison guards. And that was in part a decision based on the information and the archives that I had in front of me, because I wasn't going to tell a story about the Nation of Islam using the archives of the state, but I could tell a story about the state using the archives of the state. So part of what I came to realize in covering especially police is how this kind of – there was this simultaneous awe of the fruit of Islam about its discipline and fear. And those frequently went together, that when they would write about. So they would be surveilling, you know, a gathering in Los Angeles, and they would talk about, you know, the changing of the guard out in front. And they just wrote about it in this kind of befuddled way of like, we know that they're moving, but we can't figure out when and why. And these are the, and they saw the fruit as the police force that they were sort of, or a military force that they had to contend with. And I think, frankly, they were just petrified. I mean, they saw a discipline in the FOI that they themselves didn't have.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's it most basically.
Yeah, and the African-American community is never – what is going on in the streets? You know, I want to visit with you for a moment on the – that, and I want you to put a pin, though, because I would like for you to come back 2 weeks from now and let's finish this interview up. But I want now go to two things. I'm going to get to the non-African-American – who were in part of the Nation of Islam, Benjamin Perez, and large numbers of Latin Americans, or what the free people would call Puerto Ricans, Mexican, others, even American Indians. Will you talk about that before? I'm going to lose the train of thought. Then we're going to talk about Johnny Cochran and how the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation this actually helped develop a law practice for many African-American lawyers who might have been struggling, namely one of the bigger ones was Edward Jocko.
Those are great. I'm really glad you pulled out the first question in particular, because one of the things that, and I wish I would have written about this more in the book, honestly, but I think one of the ways that Black nationalism and especially the Nation gets talked about is in this sort of insularity or this idea that it didn't engage, not only did it not engage with other movements or other groups, but it also didn't engage with other people, that it was sort of racially insular and narrow. And then, you know, there's this sort of moment of the late 60s that gets talked about in this kind of multiracial movement, the Rainbow Coalition or Fred Hampton. And really, I think the Nation was doing that much earlier. It was multiracial organizing, and it just didn't get seen that way. And it was very, and I think in part because it was local, so it depended, right, whether it was in LA or in New York prison. So you had different ethnic groups joining the Nation of Islam, depending on where it was. But at one point, I mean, there's good way.
I would say this was a nationwide phenomenon. In some cities, the bigger cities, it happened more often. I can't speak for the penal institutions, but I do know, like in New York, we had a Caucasian American, European American, Irish American, who got special permission from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The noted assistant minister of Temple Number 27 was Brother Minister Benjamin Perez, who's a Mexican.
Yeah. Yeah, who worked with Cesar Chavez. So at one point, I had, you know, and one of the central figures really of the book is Martin Sostre, who is, you know, a Puerto Rican.
Right.
I didn't have any good way to quantify this, but at one point I took all the names that were recorded as suspected members of the Nation in New York prisons in the early 60s, and it was about 10% had Spanish surnames. So that gives you sense of just how many people, especially this is before, you know, the Young Lords and other groups inside.
Say the Nation fathered the Young Lords, the Black Panthers, and the whole multiracialism, because in the prisons, yes, anybody that were actually Caucasians would join. But I mean, the thing is, like I said, with the Chavez, Cesar Chavez's right hand man was our local minister, and I said Al because I was part of the Nation of Islam. And I always try to explain that to people, and then you put it in the book. I don't have any pictures of him. I used to see him. I used to talk to him. We had temples all over the country, but we even had a temple in Puerto Rico, in Jamaica, and that was about, because that's not a part of your work. But Martin Sostre really was one of the leading prisoners, and he was a Puerto Rican.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, remind me to send you. I've got some good photos of Benjamin Perez. I put one in the book, but I've got some other ones. So remind me to send those to you.
It was very funny. I met his daughter one day, and I was talking to her, and I said, well, you know, I was trying to introduce her to a brother for a husband. She said, you know, this ass had the nerve to tell me that I was not, what do you know about Islam? And I told him, do you know who Minister Imam Benjamin Perez is? She said, my dad, I grew up in the Nation of Islam. I said, that's right, I knew you did. She said, tell him, fool. I said, okay, fool. And she said, you fool, so I'm going to call you fool. So she laughed, but yeah, there was many families like that. And he had become prominent in the leadership, and every Savior's Day, that's the national convention, he would be up on the podium with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And actually, he was the one that arranged for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to have a house in Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, I remember too seeing in Muhammad Speaks at the end, you know, when they have all the radio broadcasts, and there would be one in Mexico,
right.
In Mexico City.
That's right.
Yep.
So you have brought out that this is an international movement for the improvement, personally, of African Americans. And next week we will. Can we do this 2 weeks from now?
Yeah,
be available?
Of course. I would love that. Yeah.
And we'll do maybe 90 minutes, but it is so interesting, and I hope I was a good host and not a professor, but asking the question. And you said such wonderful things. We have 3 minutes. Will you give us 3 minutes, kind of a summary, and announce when you'll be coming back?
Yeah, absolutely. A summary of the book?
Summary of your project. Let's summarize. Well, we don't summarize the book. Just where we are at, just some of the salient points we have brought, these arguments, and kind of put them together. As you were going to get the last thesis exam, doctoral exam, before we come back in the room to announce you're a doctor. An abstract about
okay.
Discussion.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like we've touched upon a lot of important points of the book. I mean, one of them being sort of how the Nation of Islam comes to be understood in mainstream America after the hate that hate produced in 1959, and C.R. Lincoln's work, a discussion of not just Lincoln, but a whole host of black journalists and intellectuals who sort of, well, we use the word opportunism, but, you know, used the Nation of Islam as a subject and how that affected and affects to this day our understandings of the nation. And then thinking about the nation as an international and multiracial movement. And I hope next time we can talk a little bit more about some of the specifics of the NOI's organizing in prisons and against police brutality in local communities. And I just want to thank you for having me on the show. It's really a pleasure to talk with both
of
you.
And I thank you. And like I said, and we're going to mention one of Johnny Cochran's first cases. And we'll talk to the beginning of this. I'll give you a note that we'll start out talking about the African-American lawyers and journalists being employed as a result of having to cover this movement. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thank you
Looking forward
so
to
much,
it.
Professor. And I hope you're enjoying your sabbatical, and that the future historian in the family is doing well. I'm sure you're tutoring him and bringing him into the ways of scholarship. Is he learning well?
That's a very generous reading of my parenting. Yeah, we're you know, getting him fed into bed.
Probably looking for the professor right now. Let us return to the professor. You're listening to another edition, a revived Religion Means a Lot. I'm your host, Imam Alfred Muhammad, and the co-host.
Alfred Muhammad II.
And we were with Professor Felber from the University of Mississippi. And you all were in Oxford, right?
Yep, Oxford, Mississippi.
As Bob Dylan wrote a song, Oxford Town, Oxford Town. Everybody has their head hung down, Oxford Town, Oxford, in the early morning. Well, we certainly had Oxford Town in the evening, the home of William Faulkner, and now the home of Professor Felber. Thank you. Peace be on our noble one, the honorable listening audience. Until next time on Religion Means a Lot.